This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
From the Book of Serenity, Case 75, Rayon's Constant Principle, the pointer. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigating or not? Main case. Rueyan asks Yantao, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yantao said, moving. Rueyan said, when moving, what then? Yantao said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Rueyan stood there thinking. Yantao said, if you agree, you're not yet free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in birth and death. Poem. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body, resting on nothing, stands out unique and alive. So this is, we're moving towards the end of our summer training period. This is our last hour of this session. things are in a constant state of change, so it seems. Even as you call it thus, it's already changed. In thus is the one true reality, the merging of all opposites. And yet already it's changed. What is the fundamental constant principle? Yantao says, moving. So impermanence, of course, to even say it's a central part of Buddhist teaching is, in a sense, misspeaking, because it's so essential. And what is essential in Buddhist teaching is essential because it's the way things are. It's the nature of the world and the way things interact and who we are as human beings. And so if we want to live in accord with our world, we have to understand it deeply. What is it that we call the world? And so Buddhism has many, many teachings. In a sense, all of Buddhism teachings are about impermanence in different forms. Of course, there's the change, the impermanence that we see within our body and mind moment after moment. Sitting in Sesshin, an important part of what's happening is just seeing worlds arise and dwell and then pass away. And then worlds arise and dwell and then pass away. And in some of them, they go by hardly noticed. In other of them are euphoric symphonies, triumphs, and others are crushing defeats, catastrophes, tragedies. And they abide and then they pass. And then a new one. And then another one. And then another one. And part of that, I often think of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree on the final night of his enlightenment and being assailed by Mara in all of its many forms, temptations, desires, conflicts, anger, insecurities, all of it. And the Mara had one purpose, and that was to get Buddha to get up and go away, walk away from this place, from this seat, from this commitment. The Buddha would not move. And so the kind of seasoning that happens when we sit, you know, it's like when we're young and, you know, Mom, can I have some apple juice? No. You know, my life is over. Right? Because I don't have much to relate that to. Right? I haven't had much experience yet. So that moment of, you know, tragedy seems all-encompassing. But we just keep having such moments that just, they change, right? And so part of it, the sort of seasoning process is actually seeing, gaining insight into those worlds that appear, that we invest so much in, that we rely so much upon, whether they're heavens or hells. And just see them pass, and see them pass, and see them pass, as a way to begin to develop detachment, to actually begin to see them clearly. The Buddha spoke about the fundamental changes of aging happening in every instant, of infirmity, illness, the fragility of this human body, so resplendent and resilient and yet so frail, and ultimately of our death. And we hear that so much as practitioners that we really, you know, the things we hear a lot in the teachings, we need to be very careful with, because in hearing them frequently spoken about, we can stop listening. And so to really contemplate these three essential truths of aging, illness, and death, don't pass quickly by. As Dogen says, you don't have to conjure up things in your mind to bring them to bear, just open your eyes. There's change, there's movement due to just circumstances changing, personal circumstances, relationships, work, situations. There's changes in worldly matters, worldly affairs, every day, within each generation, through eras that come and go, empires that rise and fall. The Buddha said the fundamental place of change is the skandhas. Each moment, something appears. We come into contact with it through our senses. We feel something. It's soft or hard. It's warm or cold. It's pleasurable. It's painful. And then we begin to organize around that. What is it? What do I call it? Have I seen it before? What category does it fall into? And then that leads to mental formations. What do I do about this? Do I want more of it or less? Is it friend or foe? Is it me or is it not me? And consciousness, bringing the whole together. And that in each moment, it's arising and falling. And in each moment, we invest the self into the skandhas. I am this feeling. I am this desire. What is the constant fundamental principle moving? And so the Buddha said, we grasp after what we can't control. Dukkha is not having what you want. It's not being with who you want to be with. It's the aggregates, the Buddha said, the skandhas. And so we can see this movement, this impermanence in what we want to stay going, or what we want to go staying. I was talking to somebody recently whose mother is very aged, she's in the dying process, and she's ready. She's had a good life. She wants to go. And she was asleep, and the nurse was there, hospice nurse, and she woke up, and the first thing she said was, "Get me out of here." And the nurse said, "Honey, you got to die first." First things first. My mother felt the same way. She said, why can't this be over? I'm ready for it to be over. I said, not all of you is ready for it to be over yet. All of you has to be ready. And you are not in control of all of that. The Buddha said that we tend to experience things in terms of their pain or pleasure. And when we experience something pleasurable, we want more of it. And he said, but pause, stop, and reflect right in that moment. See below the surface. Because the pleasure we experience is the promise fulfilled of that desire. That's why it's so compelling. He said, but look beneath the surface and see the danger. And the student said, what is the danger beneath the surface? And he said, impermanence. Why is that danger? It's not impermanence itself that is dangerous. Impermanence itself is just the nature of things. Why do we experience it as a danger? Wanting it to stay, it goes. Wanting it to go, it stays. And so we study. And study means we train. We practice. The koan is a way that we train. We study. It begins in the mind with words and language and meaning. All of the teachings begin that way. All of the spoken teachings begin that way. And their whole purpose, no matter how simple and direct, no matter how complex and dense and obscure they may seem, they all have one purpose. And that is to instill faith, to bring about right understanding, and then to bring us into practice, into actual practice. The teachings are never just about hearing a teaching, ever. They're always bringing us into practice so that then we can go into direct experience. So impermanence, we have an understanding about it. It's the reality in front of our eyes. We see it everywhere. Or do we? And what do we see? What is moving? What is impermanence itself? And so I was reflecting on that in terms of living a committed life, a disciplined life. For hundreds of years, Buddhist teachers have said that to live an awakened life is to live a disciplined life. And disciplined here doesn't mean, you know, a straitjacket. It means living in accord with what's true and holding yourself to that, committing yourself to that. And so what is it to live a committed life, a disciplined life, within this constant principle? Change. Rayon said, when moving, what then? Yantao said, you don't see the fundamental principle. The river doesn't track its current. The ocean doesn't know its rising and lowering tides. And yet everything moves in accord with the seasons. We think if we don't constantly measure and track and quantify, nothing will get done. Only when we stand apart, when we stand on the bank of the river, on the shore of the ocean, then we can watch and measure and track and see a kind of movement, see an aspect of impermanence, but not yet see permanence itself directly. How do we experience it directly? Enter into it. Turn towards it. When moving, how do you turn towards it? So Rayon asks, when moving, what then? Gyanto says, you don't see it anymore. How is it when you don't see it anymore? The other day when I gave a talk, I read from Master Dogen's Being Time. And I want to bring that back again. The way, Dogen says, the way the self arrays itself, presents itself, is the form of the entire world. Everything in the entire world is a display of the self. For one instant, see each thing in this entire world as one moment of time, one instant. Here, things do not hinder each other, just as moments do not hinder one another. The way-seeking mind arises in this moment. A way-seeking moment arises in this very mind. It is the same with practice and with attaining the way. Impermanence is just this. We feel hindered by change. It's too much, it's not enough. It's happening, it's not happening in our perception. Impermanence itself is never binding. When moving, what then? You don't see the fundamental principle. Rayon stood there thinking. How familiar is this? Right? We hear something we don't understand, and so what do? We immediately turn towards the place of understanding. We want to know. I don't understand. So we turn to the place where we will get some understanding. Our thinking mind, our knowing mind, our concept-making mind. Right? And we could think, say that that impulse is true. The impulse is, I want to understand. But in this case, the method is not true. Because we're turning away from that very thing by trying to understand it conceptually. And so Yan Dao says, if you agree, then you're not yet free of sense and matter. You agree, but you're caught up in the idea of it. And that idea will keep you from the truth of impermanence. Because you already know. If you don't agree, then you're forever sunk in birth and death. If you don't agree, then you're, in a sense, even more distant, and the cycle just keeps repeating itself. So what are we to do? In the commentary it says, that when asked, when you said, when moving, what then? The commentary says, Yan Dao, half drunk, half sober, half true, half false. Half correct, half incorrect. Again, lets him go, Ruiyan. He just shone through it for him, saying, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Masters of great skill admit beings in this way, admit beings to the way, bring them closer in this way. Ruiyan then stood there thinking, and the commentary says, here's where he reaches the place where the divergent roads before the dead tree cliff are many. Yan Dao already was heedless of his body and life, cutting off Ruiyan's pathway and opening up the public road to the capital, right under the sun, saying, if you agree, you're not yet free of senses and matter. If you don't agree, you're forever sunk in birth and death. Guishan calls this, another master, Guishan calls this the tooth and nail of the cave of Dharma. It captures you alive without any useless effort. Nothing wasted. So wonderful. He says, here's the place. He reaches the place where the divergent roads before the dead tree cliff are many. The dead tree is like this fabulous ash out in the meadow. In the Dharma, in Zen, it represents the body of reality, the body of emptiness, dry, withered, no juices flowing, free of all good and bad, all right and wrong, heavens and hells, dropped away. And here we're right at that divergent road before this dead tree cliff. Which way do we go? Which direction do we take? We arrive here over and over and over again. In a sense, every time something arises in our mind that just arises from our past karma, in this moment, now we're beginning to create karma. Now we're acting, we're choosing. We're setting off on a path. We're at a place of divergent paths, different possibilities, different ways we could go. Sometimes we see that we're in a moment that's very significant. Right, in my life, certainly there have been moments where I realize I am in the midst of making a decision that's going to chart a certain course of my life. Sometimes it was of my own choosing, sometimes it seemed to have been brought to me. And that moment of clear knowing, like we are at a moment of significant change right now. And of course, then there are just the innumerable, endless such moments. And we could say that training is, as he says, to cut off the pathway, cut off the old road, cut off the well-worn, habit-driven road. You've been there, you know what's going to happen, really. We know what's going to happen when we go down that road. And that's our, insanity making is we think, no, not this time, not this time. Watch, just wait and see. It's not this time. No, same. And so he's saying, cut off that pathway and open up a new road. This one is a public road, that it takes you to the Capitol right under the sun in full illumination. It's a public road. It's free. It's free to everybody. No tolls, no charge. And it's open to every creature. And it's all under the bright sun. Bodhicitta is that great aspiration that sets us off on that path to the Capitol. The Capitol is your heart of being. Buddha-dharma is the road itself. Practice and training. Commitment is every step. Vow is every step. But what is commitment? What is vow within the constant fundamental principle? Change. How can we commit to something? To an ongoing dedication, to an ongoing adherence, faithfulness in our bodies and minds, in what we're actually doing, when every single aspect of that is ceaselessly appearing and disappearing, coming and going. Whether it's an intimate relationship, whether it's bringing a child into the world, whether it's being a student, taking bodhisattva vows, ordination. How do we make a commitment which is the intention to create something lasting when every single aspect of it, you, everything within you, the commitment itself, that which we're committing to, every step along the way, is in a constant state of moving? Well, we have to rely on that which is constant, change itself. How do we rely on impermanence to make a lasting commitment or an ongoing commitment? Because commitment can only be true. We should only commit to things that are true. Right? Nobody wants to make a commitment to what's false. That's why if we're going to commit to a path, we should make sure it's a true path, true in and of itself and true for you. It might be true for others, but it's not. If it's not true for you, it's not skillful, then we shouldn't commit to it. It's because everything is impermanent, because I can't know what tomorrow is. I can't predict how my vows are going to unfold, how they will change, how they will change me, how they will change my landscape, everything I'm experiencing. And because I can't predict, because I don't know, I dedicate myself to them. I make those vows. In a certain way, it's illogical. It's crazy, right? It seems crazy. And yet it's the one true, sane thing. In a sense, we're walking the path of formlessness within vows. Remember the passage I read the other day of Bodhidharma, who said that the Buddha used the tangible to represent the sublime. And so we use that which we can see, that which we can turn our attention to, that which we can dedicate ourselves to bring forth that which is inexpressible, that which is you cannot measure or weigh or ultimately know. So as Trungpa Rinpoche said, it's like falling out of a plane. The bad news is you got no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. And that's true for everyone at every moment. That's why we keep turning the sound up so loud, to try and drown out our recognition of that fact. That is impermanence, and that is true. It's not a problem. It's not a mistake. Vows open up the road of our falling to flying. I was reading a book recently. I've been studying a book by Julie Diamond on power. I think it's called Power, A User's Manual. And I gave a copy to all the teachers. because it's a really good book about power and how to use it or not use it, use it or abuse it. And one of the things she says is that whenever we step into a role that has any kind of power, we're not ready. We're not ready because we haven't done it yet. Right? It's like when we become a student or we take bodhisattva precepts. When I took the bodhisattva precepts, I didn't really think of it that way then, but now when I look back, I realize that's exactly what I was feeling. I had just done this thing, which was very significant. I thought, wait a minute, I'm not ready. Hang on. But I'd already taken the vows. And I didn't realize that's like, yeah, right, I'm not ready, and I take these vows. And by not ready means we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how we're going to be called upon. We don't know how this is going to affect us. But it's our faith in and our examination of that gives us the madness to leap into that vow. We can't know the consequences of a commitment. I mean, you know, we can have a general sense, but that's as far as it goes. We don't know its implications. We don't know how our life is going to be changed, transformed, how our own relationship to the vows, to the commitments themselves will be changed. In a sense, we make that commitment, we make that vow to find out. And to be able to go, to dedicate ourselves into something that is that important. That's why we make commitments and vows in particular. I mean, we make different kinds of commitments, but vow is a very particular thing. Vow is reserved for those most important things. You know, you don't vow to, you know, go out and get a, you know, newspaper. Right? That's not worthy of a vow. How you go out, how you live, how you meet the world, how you conduct yourself as you go out and buy that paper, that's worthy of a vow. This path is a committed life. It is a life of vow. And that because it's so important, we don't do it right away. Right? We need to kind of get the lay of the land first. We chant the bodhisattva vows. We're being exposed to those particular vows. We study the precepts, those vows, but we're not taking them yet. That's different. And in order to do that, we have to really examine. We have to examine ourselves. We have to examine our motivation. What are we committing to? And then we have to bring that together. Is there a resonance? Is there an affinity? You know, sometimes people ask, how do I know, you know, when I'm ready to enter into training, to request the teachings from a teacher, to take the precepts, to be ordained? When those are sufficiently joined. And by sufficiently, I mean enough for you to be confident in your making of a commitment. You know, if you're waiting for 100%, you'll never get there. Right? That's an idea. That's a fantasy. We make the commitment because it's not 100%. The idea that it's 100%, that we know completely, absolutely, means we haven't examined deeply enough. But we know enough. We're clear enough, and we're willing to take that leap into the unknown, into the discovery. And at every step, then, we renew that, because it's got to be given freely, taken freely. You can't vow by force. You can't make a commitment by force. That is not. And so a person requests to enter into residency. A practitioner requests to enter into formal training. A bodhisattva, a student, asks to receive the bodhisattva precepts. A bodhisattva asks to receive ordination. At each step, there's asking. I ask freely. I ask knowingly. I ask not knowingly. And in the tradition, you know, it's the famous story of one night when the Buddha and some of his disciples were, had, you know, staying somewhere, camped somewhere, And this guy wanders into the camp, and he's dead drunk. Not a monk, just a layman. And he wanders in, comes up to the Buddha, says, "I want to be ordained." He's drunk. The Buddha ordains him. And everybody's like, "What's going on?" So the next morning, he wakes up a little more sober, looks at what's going on, and freaks out, and he splits. So he's out of there. Right? And his student says, "Why did you do that? Why did you ordain someone who clearly wasn't in full possession of their senses? They were cloudy." And he says, "Because there was a reason why he found his way here, even in that state of intoxication, and asked to be ordained. And the karma of that, the seeds of that have been strengthened by ordaining him." I don't think we would do that. I'm not that wise. And so part of it is, because part of it is we need to, because for many of us, this is, you know, some of us made commitments, and of course there's been reflection and thought, but to really sort of study making a commitment, to study taking vows, to really try and understand what is being asked of me, what am I asking of myself? And within, every day, before and during those vows, that fundamental constant principle is present. Impermanence. Everything is in a state of change. Sometimes in the monastic council, when a person is asking to be ordained, and they're saying, "I want to say yes to this life," and we say, "What life do you think you're saying yes to? Is it the life that it's always going to be just like this because this is really working for me?" You know, so what happens if all hell breaks loose, right? Nobody comes to retreats anymore, right? As far as I'm concerned, we just continue, right? Whoever shows up, that's our Sangha, right? That the monastics, we have made this our life. So if it can't work here, we'll make it work somewhere else. All is impermanent. How much more so, if you could say such a thing, is that true when you're on a path that is all about change, that is all about what we call transformation? When we're trying to interrupt in those habit patterns, which means change, we're trying to revolutionize the mind. It's all in a state of dynamic unfolding, evolving, becoming, unbecoming, coming together, falling apart, coming together, falling apart. And often because we try and reconstitute when it comes apart, we try and rebuild, until finally we realize, no, we're falling. We're flying. Trying to reconstitute is recreating my suffering. And our vows bind us to that intention, to our commitment and our path. So within, because we will, you know, within every commitment, there is already, you know, there are going to be moments where you want out. Right? I mean, you should already know that. Right? We get married, we make marriage vows, because you know already there are going to be moments where it's like, "I'm out of here." Right? And because of those vows, you don't. You hold yourself fast. You hold yourself, to your vows, to that which we've committed to. That's their function. That's why they need to be carefully examined. And so what does that all mean? Commitment, vows, within our context. When a student leaves training, when a monastic leaves the monastic life, when a person leaves a marriage. When within a commitment, the commitment changes. It's a very important question because everything is impermanent. It has always happened. It will always be happening thus. And of course, there are degrees of commitment. You know, so when somebody comes in for a week or a month or a year, or you come in for a session, one of the things we ask is, we want you to be committed to that. And that's, in a sense, a small commitment. It doesn't seem small necessarily at certain moments. It seems like a big commitment when you want out. And because we've asked you and you've been thoughtful and said, yes, I want to commit to this, hopefully that holds you so that you can see your way through. Because otherwise we leave in that moment when change is actually happening. Something is possible. And so there are some commitments, except for emergencies, that we should hold fast to because they're relatively small commitments. But what about lifetime commitments, long-term commitments? That by virtue of that commitment, things are changing. Everything is changing, not just because of impermanence, but because you're asking for that. And asking for it in a way that you already know you don't know how that's going to unfold. So when within our commitment, we're committing to something, to someone, to a path, to a life, to a session. But that's kind of the outer expression of the commitment. What is the commitment actually to? In other words, what underlies, what runs through that commitment? Why are we committing to this? If we're committing to the path as a training student, why am I committing to this? It's not just because I want to do all of these things. There's something in me that's moving me that finds its expression in my commitment to this. The path itself, a particular expression of my life as a lay practitioner, as a monastic, freedom from suffering. In that way, we're committing ourselves to something tangible, right? Something that we can see, that we're relating to, that we can kind of gauge our commitment day after day. And that is also testing us in that commitment. Because that thing I'm committing to is constantly changing. But we're doing that, aren't we? To bring out something intangible, something sublime, something ineffable. And so because of the nature of commitment, because all is moving, and within the commitment, in a sense, as he says, you don't see the constant principle. And that's one of the things that makes commitment so challenging, is when you're within it, sometimes it's hard to see that commitment. It's hard to see what's happening, the change, which is both the power, but it also can create a precariousness, because sometimes we're not seeing how things are going. We just keep absorbing everything and sort of folding it into that commitment, which in a way is the practice of that commitment. But then there's also an aspect which is reflecting on, is this serving that fundamental purpose? A marriage, training, a monastic life. And sometimes because of those changes that's happening within us, by virtue of the vows that we've taken, we are changing in ways that are true change and good change. And because of that, interestingly enough, sometimes that moves us in other directions. And when that happens, when we move away from that a commitment, it can seem as though something's wrong. Sometimes it's not a good thing because we're not really examining. We're just giving up. You know, this isn't sort of a natural and healthy process. It's really coming out of doing the work, of actually living that vow. But it's coming out of, in certain ways, not doing that. So that's sort of the escape clause. But when it actually is coming out of that process in a way that we could not have predicted, and is perhaps bringing other things into you know, our attention, other things maybe that were really motivating us earlier are not there so much. Then sometimes as a way of continuing that commitment, we shift. Commitment is freely given. It has to be. And so, but I feel like what's important is that the commitment continue, I would hope. The underlying, the basis, the essence of that commitment continues, perhaps now in another form. And so there's a continuation of discernment, of examination, of study, of reflection. And as and in that process, sometimes there's pain, there's confusion, there's sorrow. But if it's a, if it's part of that healthy process, then I think it is we're moving towards the fulfillment of those vows, the fulfillment of that essential nature of that commitment. You know, it's a live thing. I mean, that's just the fact of it. You can't predict it. We can do our best. That's what we can do. Over and over again. Over and over again. And that's also why time is a part of it. You know, to see things over time. You know, that's why the process of discernment can't be just in a moment. Like you're having one great moment. Okay, that means, you know, this is exactly what you should do. You're having a terrible moment. Okay, that means you shouldn't be doing this. I mean, that's crazy, right? We have to experience many, many moments and then have that sense of the whole and always be connected to that fundamental thread. What is this really about? Why is this important? What am I actually seeking? What is that public road that I am on that is the direction I need to be moving in? And what best serves that? So in the poem, when he says, the round pearl has no hollows, the great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. And that doesn't mean no stumbles, no imperfections. It's filled with imperfections. Having no edges, in a sense, is your fundamental nature, my fundamental nature. But it's also the perfection of a life of vow, which in and of itself has no edges because it includes everything. That's why our vows have to include, I don't know what's going to happen, and this is what I'm committing to. Removing the road of agreement, yes and no, right and wrong, insecurity, self-doubt, senses and matter are empty. So we really see into the heart of being. We understand beyond opinions and mercurial feelings and weather patterns. What is the fundamental? What is the fundamental principle of this universe, and what is the fundamental that we are seeking to make the ground of our life? Then, as he says, the free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. Flying, falling, no parachute, a life of vow. So I'll end with a poem. Oh, before I do, I wanted just to mention, and the senior will probably mention it too, that we're starting Ango next Sunday, which is exciting. And we're going to be studying the Eightfold Path, which is exciting and wonderful. And so we'll be meeting. We'll be meeting this time next Sunday to begin the Ango formally. So we'll bring out something tangible. We'll start something, right, in order to enter into the sublime. So this is a song to the old body of the Buddha standing out there in the field. The old ash tree, silent and bare of leaf and bark, sap hardened, stands glorious and unwavering. Even when the last great Arctic wind brings it down, to meet its dusty maker. It will be unwavering in its unspoken devotion. To whom is such loyalty given? Is there anyone who is not warmed by the morning sun's radiance?
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.